You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us.
You are with Radio MMT at 3CR Community Radio, and I am Anne, your host for the next hour. And our astute and regular listener might already be wondering what has happened to Kevin. And you might remember that he jumped in his van and then he headed north looking for warmer climates. So let's get him on the line and find out just where on earth Kevin is today. Hey, Kevin, where are you?
Hiya, Anne. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
I'm in Taree. Taree was in the news not so long ago because it flooded.
So what's going on?
I got out of Melbourne because I live in my van, and living in a van in Melbourne is a bit grim during the winter because you're sort of locked in a little box, and if you can't open the doors, it's a little bit confining. So I thought I'd go somewhere where it's warmer. It is warmer here, but it's rather wet. So there were floods here earlier this year, and I'm sitting next to the Manning River in Taree, and it's about 300 metres wide. It's beautiful river. It's like looking at a painting. It's like I'm in a painting with the hills in the distance and this beautiful wide river, which often has a perfect reflection of the landscape in the distance. But it's wide. It's like 300 metres wide, and beyond that there are farms and farmlands and paddocks and stuff. So when I pulled up here, I pulled up next to the Manning River Rowing Club, which is down by the river there. And I used to row, so I got speaking to a guy who walked up, who just happens to be president of the rowing club.
Okay.
And I said, "This is a nice looking building here." And he goes, "Yeah, you know," because I'm a builder. Actually, we rebuilt this in 2019 when a hurricane came through, like a little typhoon came through, ripped the roof off it, and then it got flooded in 2021. So it's got a downstairs area where all the boats are, and then there's the next level up is a big room where they've now put a cafe in. And he said the water came all the way up to the second level in 2021, whilst they were doing the renovation. And earlier this year, it came past the first floor and up to the door handles up on the second level. And you just look across this vast expanse of river, 300 metres wide, and you just think, how much water...
Did it take to fill that big bathtub?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've said to a couple of the locals around here, I said, well, you know, it's global warming. These are country people. All right, don't talk about global warming and climate change. It won't go down well up here. And I'm saying to them, well, this was predicted. You know, there was floods back in the 70s that were big, and the ones in 2019 were bigger. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, yeah, they're only once in a 50-year flood. Well, then 3 years later, another one comes along, and now they're beginning to scratch their heads a bit.
Well, look on the bright side, Kev. It's job security for a handyman.
Well, yes, there's plenty of all my jobs have to do with water damage so far. but it reminds us, like you know, we're involved in this economics movement because we're concerned about what the current economic settings are doing to the environment and where this is all going to go. And this is it. You know, like you're in it here.
Yeah. Well, speaking of economic settings and how economic policy interacts with global warming policy, I think we've got the perfect person to speak with today. So I'm not alone in the studio in Melbourne, Kev.
You've replaced me already.
That's right. So let me introduce you to our guest today, who is Colin Long.
There?
Colin Long, I've got with me from Trades Hall. Hi, Colin. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, Anne. How are you?
Very good.
G'day, Kev.
How you doing, Colin?
Good, thanks.
And I think Colin's a great person because you know how we always say that at Radio MMT here that we like to talk about economics for the rest of us.
Yeah.
I think Colin's pretty into economics for the rest of us as well. Is that putting words in your mouth, Colin?
No, that's very true. I mean, I also work on climate and energy policy for Trades Hall, but you can't talk about climate and energy policy without thinking about the bigger economic picture and the macroeconomic picture in particular. So
there you go. Yeah. Yes. Well, I should tell people that your current position, I believe, is Just Transitions Organiser at Vic Trades Hall. Have I got that right?
Yes, that's right. So climate, energy, just transition policy.
And I want to point out a few highlights from your resume because they do sort of speak to someone who is very committed to doing solidarity work, I feel. So you can tell me if I've got these ones right. You were past Victorian Secretary of the National Tertiary Education Union, the NTEU.
Yes, that's right.
You admit to that
You've done your research.
And were you actually president of the Vic Trades Hall at one point?
I was, yes.
I'm wondering too, there's an organisation called the Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, which are an international alliance of trade unions advocating for a just energy transition. Are they still going?
Oh, yes, very much so. It's a very successful, very large international alliance of trade unions from all across the world. Big representation from South America, parts of North America, Asian unions and European unions as well. And they've actually done some good work on MMT and particularly looking at role of MMT style thinking for developing nations.
Are the people already interested or were you sort of pointing them in that direction?
Oh, no, I'm not even sure I was leading in it. There was a couple of characters who were New York based who were within the central organisation of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. And they were interested in MMT, and they were just interested in challenging this was really being written at the height of the COVID epidemic, so 2020-21.
That's when we were all due for a reset, wasn't it?
Yeah. And they were really thinking about some of the discourse in climate and energy policy, even being echoed by unions around how we needed to tax the wealthy to get the sort of things we need.
And okay, that's the sad, sad, misguided story.
Yes, exactly. And I think back four or five years ago, in that height of COVID, there was increasing interest in MMT because everyone could see all of a sudden that governments weren't particularly constrained by how much they could tax or how much they could borrow.
Right.
So I think people were starting to realise that a bit more broadly.
It was a wake-up call, wasn't it? I remember that.
Yeah, a lot of it's been lost, I think. The mainstream discourse has reasserted
itself.
Yeah,
the story really bounced back pretty quick. Yeah. I watched that happening too.
It's amazing how quickly they forget, isn't it? You know, there it is right in front of you and everybody goes, see, we're not crazy, and then a couple of years afterwards, they go, oh, no, you're crazy again.
Yeah.
So give us an idea of what the day-to-day life is for a Just Transitions organiser and what even you might think about as far as a just transition and what are we transitioning out of and into and all of that.
Well, I'd like to say we were transitioning from a fossil fuel-based economy to a renewables-based economy, but that's a very slow and patchy process at the moment.
And especially with Woodside.
Yeah, Woodside and coal and gas companies all over the place. And, you know, Australia still committed to expanding or building new fossil fuel projects. It makes it very difficult because it is actually quite difficult to transition workers out of fossil fuel jobs. They've generally been well unionised good jobs that provide well and have created good lives for a lot of workers. And what we want to do through Just Transition is ensure those workers aren't thrown on the scrap heap, and that all of the difficulties of transition aren't put onto their backs alone, and that they have good jobs to go to. So that's the essence of a Just Transition.
Just on that, Colin. Now, I have actually worked in a coal mine before. I worked as a communications cableman. I was doing fibre optic stuff up near Mudgee back about 15 years ago. And what became pretty apparent was that most of the work around these fossil fuel projects, the construction jobs when they're building the project, but once they're up and running, they don't employ many people at all. There's a lot of automation, and they run very much on skeleton crews, and it's mainly just maintenance crews making sure everything's working okay.
Yeah, that's true. And there's been quite a lot of job loss in mining in general, not just in coal mining, but things like iron ore too. And a lot of that's through automation, actually. Very little of it to do with climate policy in general. But it is also true that there's reasonable amounts of job creation in renewables, but the maintenance jobs in renewables, there's not many of them either.
True. I mean, a lot less maintenance than these conveyor belts at coal mines, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And renewable energy is a form of energy automation, as I say, but that just raises the question about who owns the generation assets, and makes the argument for me, for public and social ownership of energy generation, so that the benefits can be returned to the community rather than being creamed off by overseas companies that don't pay any royalties or taxes or any benefits at all to the community, and use a whole lot of resources, such as labour, that could be gainfully employed in the energy transition.
The prospect that's put to us is that, oh, what about the jobs? What about the jobs? Well, there's not many, that many jobs that are going to be lost either way. So it's a bit of a false cry. If there's plenty of work to do elsewhere, there's lots of other things being developed, and it's just a matter of trying to find where those jobs that are lost, it can be redeployed, and that's where you come in, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And you're right. I mean, in coal-fired power stations in Australia, there is less than 9,000 workers employed across the country. So we're not talking huge numbers, but none of those people should be thrown on the scrap heap. They should all be transitioned to decent work. But we have the capacity to do that. And I think MMT tells us that the government can mobilise the resources to do that. And the limitation is not a fiscal one. The limitation is about the creation of new jobs and the mobilisation of broader resources to provide people with jobs and useful economic activity. But it's certainly not a fiscal one. I saw some news recently about this great disappointment that Adani, the mine that they built in central Queensland, which one of the justifications for the construction of that mine, of course, was that it was going to provide all this tax and other revenue that would fund schools and health services and so on. And of course, they haven't paid any tax. But the lie in the first place was that we needed their money and their tax money to pay for those things.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what MMT tells us. So MMT is telling us, one, the Australian federal government can never run out of dollars. Yeah. And two, it can use those dollars to buy whatever is for sale in the Australian dollars, including unemployed labour. And three, if they're the currency issuer and they're never going to run out of dollars, they're not taxing us in order to get the dollars. And so, of course, once you understand that, you realise how much propaganda there is around.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't particularly want Gina Reinhardt or Clive Palmer dictating what schools and what's going to be on the curricula, you know. But
the thing that most annoys me at the moment, and I hear it all over the place, I heard it on an Australia Institute podcast recently. I saw it in a Paul Mason newsletter. Paul Mason's an English social democrat. He's written some interesting books in the past, but he's just become a member of the Starmer Labor Party cheer squad in recent years. But both of them essentially saying the only way we're going to get the money we need to provide the services that the community needs is if we can tax rich people to provide that money. And what really infuriates me about that is it says we need rich people.
Mm. Yeah.
Why are so-called leftists arguing that we need rich people to get the things we need as a community? I just find it a most bizarre argument. And people sit back, oh, right, no, you're right. But we don't like rich. We don't like really wealthy people, but we are saying we need them.
Mm. And Colin, just to round out our introduction to you before we get on to the reason I invited you in today, which has to do with an event coming up this Friday. But already we've sussed out that you're very MMT friendly. So
sorry, I've interrupted your introduction.
Very long introduction.
Yeah. And then Kevin interrupted your interruption.
Don't you worry about interrupting, Colin. I'm the king of interruptions.
You're both in the bad books now. Your MMT story, perhaps, Colin, and just how you got into it.
Where does my MMT awareness come from? I suppose it goes back to... probably the global financial crisis, maybe a bit after that, when trying to understand what was going on and the ability of governments to take on a whole lot of toxic private debt onto public balance sheets. And where they were finding the money to do that. And if we remember, was it Bernanke? He said, well, we taxpayers are not paying for this.
Mm-hmm.
We are actually just writing numbers into balance sheets, into bank accounts. It's every now and again a central banker will tell the truth or let it slip.
They let it slip out.
Now and again.
Mm-hmm. do you think, I'm racking my head about this at the moment, do you think if people could understand where money comes from, that it's not an invention of the private sector, that it doesn't come from rich people, but that it actually comes from the government, they create this stuff? Is that too hard a concept for the public to get their heads around?
Well, I think it contradicts so much political, cultural and social baggage that people have. And people, you know, most people work outside of the public sector, although the public sector, broadly defined, is reasonably large. But most people have a sense of, well, I'm working, I'm doing all this useful stuff, I'm getting paid, and then I'm paying my tax. The reason I'm paying tax is to provide the government with money. That narrative is so strong.
Mm. Yeah, it's a big hurdle to overcome. It's like, what?
Yeah, it's the point of view of the currency user, isn't it? And we don't get to see the currency issuer side, so why wouldn't we think that?
Yeah, and of course, still people say to you all the time, well, the government has to balance its books like a household does, and you know it's got to.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear, I mean,
we hear the treasurer.
The treasurer say things like the opposition says it all the time, and then people get confused because state governments don't have that same ability to. They don't issue a currency, so that they are currency users. So people are not quite sure what level of government is capable of doing what and all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things to tease out to really get your head around. And I know when I was first learning all this stuff, I think it took me at least a year just to get the basics under my belt.
Yeah.
Mm. Most of that is overcoming misinformed preconceptions, trying to undo what's been drummed into you, which is misinformed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hard part. Once that veil drops, you go, but the hard part is pushing through what's been drummed into people when they're saying that they're paying their taxes and they just can't get that out of their head.
Mm.
Yeah. It's always interesting, I think, that something I learnt from Bill Mitchell, that, you know, in one of his books where they mention if in the US, probably in Australia, although I'm not sure with the plastic currency, but if you paid your taxes in actual cash, they just go and burn it. They don't...
It's breaded, yeah.
That's the image that really gets people thinking. Well, Colin, there's an event coming up that you will be speaking at this public policy forum, and that's going to be next Friday. So Friday, August the 15th, 2025, starting at 9:30, goes to 1 p.m., and it will be at Victorian Trades Hall in Solidarity Hall, and that's at 54 Victoria Street, Carlton. And this forum is called A New Economic Vision for the Labour Movement. And tickets are free and it's open to the public. But I think organisers would like you to RSVP. So to get hold of a seat, just go to the Humantix website.
Humantix.
Humantix.
Yeah, because there's an I in there as well.
Okay, go to the Humantix website and just search New Economic Vision. I think it'll come up then.
Just turn up.
Just turn up?
I'm looking at it right now. I looked it up and this New Economic Vision website came straight up. It's all there.
Okay, it's an easy thing to get a ticket online or just show up if you're in Melbourne next Friday.
They're not going to kick you out, are they?
No, we won't. There's plenty of room. I'd love it if there was too many people.
Yeah. What we might do is take a break and then we'll come back and take note of this fantastic lineup of speakers, which includes Colin, and then we'll talk a little bit about what this new economic vision might look like.
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
And this is Anne and Kev, Radio MMT. Kev's on the line and with us is Colin Long from Trades Hall Council in our Melbourne studio at 3CR.
Hey, can I just make a comment on one of those promos you played? The one about the protest.
Yes,
that's an issue because they're talking about exclusion zones around churches, etc., and they're putting in all these little clauses. This is Labor governments really cracking down on public dissent and protest and the rest of it. Mm-hmm. You know, every protest march I go on around Melbourne ends up swinging around St Paul's just opposite Flinders Street Station there. So what they're essentially saying is, well, that's going to be out of bounds now because you're near a church. It's not good. They're using all these sneaky little clauses to stop dissent, and there's a lot to be dissenting about.
Well,
there you go.
We're going to find more than one way to start putting a bit of pressure on the Labor Party, who are comfortably in government at the moment.
Yeah.
And this event that we're going to talk about with Colin, it is called A New Economic Vision for the Labor Movement. So it's not necessarily just the Labor Party, is it, Colin?
No, that's right. Although we do have a Labor MP speaking, which will be interesting.
So that'll be Dr. Karina Garland.
Yep.
And I know she's had some experience with insecure work, so I'll be really interested to hear what she has to say.
Yeah, she has a good trade union background, comes out of the United Workers Union, spent some time as an assistant secretary at Trades Hall before she was elected to Parliament.
That's kind of encouraging to see an ALP MP attending an event with Bill Mitchell at it.
Bill Mitchell, who is, of course, the co-founder of MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, and who understands how we can have a full employment economy and make a just transition. He understands how we can do that financially. And some of the other people who are going to be speaking, there's Desiree Kai from the Tomorrow Movement. I don't know a whole lot about the Tomorrow Movement.
Tomorrow Movement is a youth organisation.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while they were pushing the job guarantee very hard. So they understand that sort of thing. So they're a very good organisation, as I said, focusing on young people, particularly trying to deal with the climate crisis, but they've got a much broader vision of a better society.
I
I thought I might have seen them campaigning for a green jobs guarantee in Canberra at one point during the lockdowns.
Yeah, I think that would be right. Yeah.
And also we're going to be hearing from Emma Dawson, who is a public policy expert, and she's currently with the Chifley Institute. Now, I don't think she would describe herself as an MMT-er as such, but there's a fair amount of overlap.
She seems to be coming across micro step by micro step.
Well, we don't want to just be talking to the converted, you know. We want to have a discussion. And Emma is now at the Chifley Institute, I think, which is effectively the ALP's
think tank. Yeah.
So Emma's will probably be speaking, not necessarily saying official ALP policy at all, but she'll be engaging with MMT and the job guarantee stuff. So we think it's important to engage with a broader audience, and particularly with governments, and try to get them to understand what MMT is and the job guarantee is.
Mm. She's very intelligent, very articulate, Emma Dawson.
And we've also got Tim Kennedy, who is the National Secretary of the United Workers Union. Mm. Now, that's the union that represents all these essential workers that we discovered during the COVID lockdowns.
Well, certainly some of them. It's got a wide range of membership. Some workers in pharmaceutical manufacture, some in chemicals, warehousing, hospitality, so a pretty broad-ranging membership. But as you said, they've got essential workers in food supply chains, warehousing, all of that sort of stuff, yeah.
The ones that are often overworked and underpaid unless they're in a union.
Yes. Yeah, and the UWU is a terrific union. They've been doing great work organising some lower-paid workers, including in agricultural sector. They also have agricultural sector workers.
Right, right. So a few different perspectives coming from the left in the one room. That's going to be this next Friday, August the 15th, at Trades Hall, Solidarity Hall. Get your tickets from Humanitics with an I.
you said Bill Mitchell was going to be there, but it's always worth listening to Bill.
Always, yep.
He always likes to prod and poke and agitate and get you thinking. So
he takes no prisoners, Bill.
You know, the most uncompromising purist I've had to deal with.
You don't start a school of economics by waffling around. So Colin, without doing any spoilers or putting words into the mouths of the other speakers, I'm just wondering what kind of a new economic vision might we hope to hear about on Friday, or what are you hoping to hear about in this vision that you might be offering to the labour movement?
Well, I think because it's a labour movement run and focused event, we will have a focus on the world of work and employment. And I'm really hoping there will be serious discussions about a job guarantee and what that would mean. And for someone like Bill Mitchell, that's central to his conception of modern monetary theory and to his conception of macroeconomics, I think. So, and there's a lot of people in the trade union movement, I think, who don't really understand what that would entail.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really hoping there's some discussion about that. I'm going to be saying some things about this, what I was talking about earlier, that we shouldn't be advocating that we need rich people to get the services and things we need. I think that needs to be said in front of an audience of so-called leftists.
Yeah, well, maybe we should jump in and let me give a starting definition of a job guarantee, and we can maybe expand a little bit on that. So there's a few characteristics of a job guarantee that are must-haves. If you don't have them, you don't have a proper job guarantee. And that is that it is the federal government who is making an unconditional offer of a job to anyone who's willing to work. So it's not means-tested. You don't have to live in a certain place. You just have to be willing to work. And this job would be paid at the federal minimum wage at a socially inclusive level. So this means that it's a real job, real work at a real wage, and it would be funded by the federal government, because as we know, it is the federal government who can never run out of the Australian dollars. But we're not necessarily talking about some big brother central planning thing, because many of the MMT economists talk about it being administered at the local community level. So we're empowering communities to say what kind of work they would like to see being done in their community by job guarantee workers. So Colin, how would you expand on what you see as the selling points of a job guarantee?
Well, there's so many, actually. and I probably have a slightly different, more expansive view of a job guarantee, which it'll be interesting to see if someone like Bill Mitchell would like to disagree with me on it. Hmm. But for a while, I was quite interested in universal basic income.
Mm-hmm.
I can see some of the attractions of the thinking around a universal basic income around things like reducing the priority of work in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I agree with Bill Mitchell to the extent that work is still important for a lot of social meaning in people's lives. And one of the reasons why I've drifted away from universal basic income is I think people should probably work to some extent for a living, and just giving people money to do nothing is potentially problematic.
Mm.
But I think the idea of somewhat reducing the importance of work and giving people the opportunity to do more in their lives than just toil as wage slaves,
mm-hmm,
is important.
Mm.
I was having a conversation this afternoon, Colin, with a fella called Mick, who's a retired butcher, and he ran his own business. And he said that he was working and working and working and then finally retired, and he's sitting around. He's just gone back to do a bit of work because he's kind of lost he lost connection. And it's not so much the work as the amount of work. And so something like a job guarantee, as Anne said, it would become the de facto minimum wage. But you could also organise it so that it reduced working hours, that you get paid a minimum wage for working 30 hours a week.
Well, that's precisely where I was going.
I'll let you go there then.
Okay. Oh, no, that's good, Kev. And yeah. I also think the benefit of that is we can combine it with a campaign for reduced working hours in the economy more generally. So I think we should, as a trade union movement, be advocating for a 30-hour working week in general.
Yeah.
At
that level, we are behind what John Maynard Keynes was predicting.
Yeah.
We're
still doing twice.
Yeah.
What he expected we'd be doing at this stage. But yeah, a 30-hour working week for everyone, it gives you the benefits of reducing people's being totally absorbed by paid labour. It gives people more opportunity to do other things, which is what the UBI advocates say. But it does away with some of those other problems, I think, of UBI, which is about giving money to people with no expectation to do anything particular in return. And I think that one of the bigger problems with UBI is it's potentially inflationary in a way that the job guarantee I don't think is.
If you just give a whole bunch of money to a whole bunch of people, then anybody who has any sort of control over prices will just jack everything up to absorb it. That's the kind of impression I get with the UBI.
Yes, and as we know, with MMT, the main consideration, I mean, people say, oh, but you believe in MMT, what about inflation? You spend all this money, and you say, well, we're deeply concerned with inflation. Inflation is the thing that really restricts government capacity, and inflation is mainly caused by lack of resources. For me, one of the big sources of restraint in in the energy transition is lack of workforce and lack of workers. So that drives the inflation in labour costs in renewables. But we could deal with that, for instance, by taking labour away from fossil fuel projects. Mm. And so that you stop fossil fuel projects, and that puts labour into renewables. And when you start to think about MMT, it's those sorts of questions you're dealing with. It's not thinking about, oh, can we tax money out of Adani to pay for things?
Yeah, it's really interesting thinking about the job guarantee is that you don't ever think about it in isolation, do you?
So no.
You're thinking about it in terms of your whole labour force and all your resources. And, of course, as you're mentioning, the universal basic income is sort of like the competing policy in that particular space for how do you give everybody an income, because in a monetary system, which we are born into and we have no choice, if we want to get our needs met and even our wants met, we have to participate in the monetary system. And we see these days that so many people are locked out of it. And one reason, of course, is because currently the way the government manages the economy and tries to prevent the thing that they are most concerned about, which is inflation, is they do that with a pool of unemployed people.
Yeah.
That's got to be one of the strengths of this job guarantee, is that essentially you're dealing with an unemployment situation, and currently we create unemployment through government policy and punish people on it by making them exist at half the poverty rate, mm. as if that's a good way to deal with the problem.
Yes.
Whereas a job guarantee does the exact opposite. It's inclusive. It allows people to, the same people who are looking for a job, to become included in society and in the economy and not feel like they're stigmatised.
Yeah, well, just recently I did hear the Minister for Social Services, Tanya Plibersek, being interviewed on a Guardian podcast back on the 1st of August 2025, and she was being asked about what Labor intended to do to get unemployment under 4%. And she said, well, of course we want to see more people get a job, and this fits very well with our productivity agenda.
Tanya Plibersek is one of Labor's most recognisable faces and the Minister for Social Services in the Albanese government. I think if there's one issue that animates our readership at Guardian, it's the rate of job seeker and the push generally for an increase to the rate. Where is the government up to on thinking in that space?
Well, we've already raised the rate by $3,600 a year. So we're not starting from zero. The people who talk about raising the rate talk about it as though it hasn't been raised. Mm. There's been a very substantial increase since we came to government. We absolutely want to see more people get a job, because with unemployment in the low fours, this is the best opportunity, the best time we have to move people from long-term unemployment into work, because working is not just good for people's incomes. It's not just good for national productivity. It's good for, you know, our feelings about ourselves. When we're kids, the first thing people ask us when they meet us is, what do you want to be when you grow up? So as well as talking about increasing job seeker and other payments, we need to talk about how we tackle entrenched disadvantage and getting people into jobs. I think that's a really good opportunity for us in the next few years, and fits very well with our productivity agenda as a government as well. Now, that's not to ignore the fact that some people struggle for a range of reasons to find work, whether it's where they're living, the local economy where they're living, or whether it's, you know, their age and they're experiencing age discrimination from employers. There's a whole range of reasons that it's hard to find work, and people should be able to live with dignity when they can't find work. We're certainly not for a moment saying, you know, pull your socks up, get out there. That's all you need to do. So we'll continue to look for opportunities to increase support for people who are on social security benefits when they can't work. A big part of our agenda, our social services agenda and our productivity agenda, is to create the opportunities for people to get decent, secure employment when they can.
I'm Tom McElroy.
So she seems very keen to have people have the dignity of work, but she was a bit short on details for how she was going to make that happen.
Yeah, look, so long as the Labor Party maintains the NAIRU as part of their... Yeah. If they recognise the NAIRU, I have a problem with that. And also, this productivity they're talking about, productivity equals profit for the owners of business. That productivity is increasingly not shared with the workers. So all this talk about productivity.
Kev, I read that quote out to provoke Colin, not you.
No, go, Kev, you go for it.
Well, I was having this discussion with an employment fellow the other day, you know, talking about increased productivity. He actually thinks that productivity is going to max out. You can't get that much more productivity out of people. But that productivity doesn't seem to be translating to wages and workers. It just seems to be fueling profits for the wrong end of town. Colin, would you agree or would you have a comment on that?
I completely agree. There's this presumption that increasing productivity naturally and inevitably flows through to better wages for workers, but it just ignores that you have to have a mechanism for the workers to take some of that benefit. What we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years is an increasing return to capital from economic activity and economic growth and productivity improvements, and a declining rate of return to labour. And that is largely because of the decline of the trade union movement, which has been a deliberate policy from governments of both stripes, actually, to restrain organised labour and to make it difficult. But there's no natural law that says improved productivity will flow through to workers. In the absence of strong unions and other mechanisms, improved productivity flows through to increased profits, as you say.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They're just saying we want more, and because the union movement has declined, that power has been diminished, and that more just means more and more profit for the wrong end of town.
And one of the big attractions of the job guarantee for me as a trade unionist is that it eradicates the use of a reserve army of labour to undermine workers, to undermine organised labour. And that's what the Reserve Bank does when it increases interest rates. It tries to drive up the rate of unemployment to put pressure on employed workers to moderate their wage demands, weakens labour in general and weakens organised labour, whereas the job guarantee ensures that the reserve army of labour just can't be used in that way because there isn't one.
Mm. The whole downward pressure on wages that they say with, you know, increasing interest rates, they say is to control inflation because it's going to reduce the costs of doing business, which equals more profits. Again, it's a disguise. They're using inflation to disguise the ulterior motive in these things, which is if you put downward pressure on wages, profits increase, again, for the wrong end of town.
Mm. Yeah.
So we do need a new economic vision, and you will hear it next Friday,
yes.
August the 15th at Trades Hall, 9:30 a.m., and you can just rock up and, yeah, get inspired.
I might just throw in a little ad because I've been involved with this. You could also see the Trades Hall, another stage of Trades Hall has been restored recently. We've just finished it. I've been working on that for Trades Hall, and so if you want to have a look at that, you might be able to have a sneaky look at that as well.
Oh, fantastic. It's such an historic building. It's just
which part has been fixed up now?
Well, the Victoria Street wing and then the southern section, so the oldest part of the building dating from 1874 and then the 1925 section, all beautifully restored.
People should come to the new economic vision just to have a look at the latest renovations.
Yeah, yeah.
You're promising it like a little tour afterwards.
maybe.
Who knows?
Depends how many people.
Well, I was going to lob a really big one at you right at the end, Colin.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, if we do look at this new economic vision based around some of the MMT, which talks about a job guarantee, which is a way to have a full employment economy that leaves nobody behind, can we do that? Can we have a full employment economy using our resources and also stay within planetary boundaries? In other words, face up to one of these planetary boundaries we're currently hurtling through, which is global warming?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd be interested to hear what Kev got to say, actually, so I'll try and say something quickly.
I won't interrupt.
Yeah, and that's right. Yes, I think we can. In fact, it's vital that we MMT gives us the tools to understand. Again, MMT is basically about proper use of resources. Mm. And so much of our resources currently are wasted in various ways. As I said earlier, we waste a lot of labour resources in fossil fuel industries. We need to take those labour resources from there to renewables. There's a huge amount of work to be performed in retrofitting buildings of all sorts, houses in particular, for energy efficiency. Various people, especially in the UK, have recommended that as kind of an MMT-like policy where mm-hmm. the state can simply pay for that labour to be performed because, as you said before, if you can pay for it in Australian dollars, then the Commonwealth government can do it and mm-hmm. you can pay for Australian labour. So we can do a lot of very rapid and large-scale work, things like ecosystem restoration, all those sorts of things. If we're basically the main cost is labour, mm-hmm. Then there's no doubt we can do that.
You've got the whole care economy. You know, there's all this talk about our increasingly aged population who aren't being looked after properly, and you've got mums and dads who have to go to work and pay for childcare. All this stuff could be shoved across to a more caring community, and that would be lovely to live in.
It's the well-being economy.
The well-being economy, that's the word I was after.
Yeah, and we could take aged care and childcare out of the hands of private profiteers, which would be a very good thing.
Yes, there's so much we could do. If only we had the political will. But I always think of MMT as the good news. We're the good news show.
Yes.
And Colin, you've proven that yet once again. And people can hear more of what you have to say if they come along to the forum next Friday at Trades Hall. So, Kev, happy travels, and we'll talk to you next time, hey?
Yeah, I'd love to come down for this conference. If you can make it, you should go, because it's a great lineup you've got there of people speaking. So you'd be mad not to go.
Thanks for joining us at Radio MMT. And coming up here on 3CR, we have Mafelda.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/Radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalent, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.